The views expressed in this program are those of the participants.
Senator? There are over 12,000 personnel quartered in each of those complexes. Each complex is over 800 floors deep.
You know, Phillips, every time I check your budget figures, I ask myself the same question. Is time travel really worth all this?
Senator, the control of time is potentially the most valuable treasure that man will ever find.
And it's certainly the most costly.
Welcome, everyone. It is Wednesday, October 22nd, 2025. I'm Bob Metz, and this is Just Right, broadcasting around the world and online. Join us for an hour of discussion that's not right-wing. It's Just Right.
Fade into color, color into black and white. Under the bedclothes, everything will be alright.
The control of time is potentially the most valuable treasure that man will ever find. Well, our topic of discussion today will give the truth of those words an entirely different meaning than anything associated with time travel. So can you spare some time for a very unusual discussion? But if not, I would encourage you to make the time, because it may be time well spent. In fact, my using the very terms time to spare and make the time and time well spent strike at the heart of our conversation today, which is only nominally about the nature of time, but predominantly about how human perception of time directly affects its culture in ways that you might never imagine. This is no mere rabbit hole we'll be jumping into today. We'll be diving into an infinite tunnel of time. So, to save time, we'll start that discussion right after reminding you that you can write us at feedback at justwritemedia.org, hear us on WBCQ and on Channel 292 Shortwave, follow and like us on your favorite podcast platform, and visit us at justwritemedia.org, where you can access all of our social media links, archive broadcasts, and the support button that makes it easy for you to support the show. Because, as always, your financial support is appreciated and is what makes this show possible. During my preparation for last week's show on identity politics, I ran across a couple of podcasts, both made by UK podcaster Connor Tomlinson, who is the host of Tomlinson Talks at lotuseaters.com, and which were posted a couple of months apart from each other, one this month in October and another just this past August. I was hoping to include them as part of last week's show, but then after listening to them carefully, I realized what Tomlinson was talking about was profound and demanded at least an entire broadcast dedicated to the disturbing zeitgeist he described. Most importantly, I learned something new that not only makes a lot of sense, but explains a few of my own observations throughout my worldly experiences whose causes I may have attributed to mistaken assumptions. Now, last week our theme was about the folly of multiculturalism, about which we concluded that the crisis of multiculturalism has reached a point where many are asking if it's even possible to have a multicultural society at all. But if the question is asked in those terms, the answer is no, it is not possible. However, if the question asked concerns the possibility of a multiracial society in which people can live together in harmony, well, the answer to that is a resounding yes. Confusing the term multicultural with multiracial is a profound error. Race is about skin color and physical features. Culture is about ideas and values which can be shared or opposed by people of all races. Now, if you ever want to see an illustration of that principle on steroids, what we're about to hear is it. These may be the most disturbing and powerful arguments against so-called multiculturalism that I have heard in a long time. Again, this is about culture and philosophy and not about skin color or ethnicity. In this first audio bite selection from Connor Tomlinson's October 6th warning entitled, "We Don't Understand How Africa Thinks," we, being those of us inculcated in a Western culture, are really given something to think about.
Do you remember after the Black Lives Matter riots of 2020 and the subsequent critical race theory cultural revolution that swept all of America and even Britain and Europe's institutions, the Smithsonian posted this chart which said that being on time, speaking English, and taking personal responsibility is white supremacy? It turns out they might have been right. Because if you just ask African people about their culture, the future is not a concept. Long-term planning, not a concept. Personal responsibility, not a concept. And so we need to understand how these people think if they are in our civilizations and if our governments, against our wishes, keep bringing more of them in. Because you have to understand, without being cruel, if you input a foreign culture with such alien understandings of things like time and planning for the future into your civilization, you don't get the same civilization at the end of it, even if they're perfectly nice people. So the chart in question says that rugged individualism, the individual being the primary unit, self-reliance, independence and autonomy, and being rewarded for the fruits of your labor, are associated with white culture. What they mean is Anglo-Saxon Protestant culture, settler culture. Our understanding of ethics and family structure and the future was also the foundation for the Anglo-Saxon Protestant cultures of the Anglosphere, Australia, New Zealand, Canada, and America. And they said about the emphasis on the scientific method, history being a heavy focus on the British Empire, the primacy of Western, Greco-Roman, and Judeo-Christian. I've never met a Judeo-Christian, so let's just say Jewish and Christian traditions. The Protestant work ethic, religion with Christianity being the norm, and anything except Judaism and Christianity is foreign. And then it gets time. And it says, follow rigid time schedules, and time being viewed as a commodity. Now, we've long had jokes about Africa timing, and it's always been kind of a joke, and we didn't really understand it, but this African woman went viral recently, because she explains why the future is not a concept in African philosophy and culture.
What if I told you that for many African societies, the concept of the future doesn't exist, and that instead of time moving forwards, time actually moves backwards? This was the work of John Mbiti, one of Kenya's and Africa's greatest philosophers. And in 1969, he wrote something that completely reimagines the way we think of African time. Mbiti says time is a two-dimensional phenomenon with a long past, vibrant present, and virtually no future. Using Swahili words, he describes the two dimensions of time, the first one being sasa, the now, the recent past, and the immediate future which can be experienced. The second dimension is zamani. Zamani is the vast, endless past where all events eventually go on to live forever. But the future, in African thought, it barely exists.
Let's just pause on that for a moment. The future, in African thought, and she's describing the culture of a continent, by the way, she may be compressing the culture and flattening it down. There might be discrete differences between different tribes. However, given the lack of development in the continent until the British Empire showed up and introduced them irrigation and the wheel and agriculture, perhaps simplification is warranted. She says, in African languages and culture, for thousands of years, there is no concept of the future. How do you plan? How do you think about the consequences of your actions? How do you have a predictable routine? How do you build a civilization where you rely on every single person in the civilization to be a constituent part of the greater whole, all doing their jobs so that things function? The answer is you can't. Like, nothing is reliable. Everything is random. And also, everything is out of your hands, because if everything has already happened in the Zamani, it means that you can't influence future events. You just sort of have to wait for events to emerge out of the Zamani and happen to you. So everything is very passive, and nobody's to blame for their own circumstances. So this is a completely alien way of how we think about things in the Hellenistic, Christian, European world. This is why time being rigid and consecutive and being a commodity that you can identify, compartmentalize, that is not a concept in Africa. And so that's not a concept to Africans who live in our country.
Because time is made up of events. Time has to be experienced in order to be real. So because we can't conceptualize events tied to the distant future because they haven't been experienced yet, then therefore the future cannot constitute part of time.
This explains milling. This explains why men from the Horn of Africa just sit around on benches barefoot in the middle of the day, thanks to the Boris Wave, because they're literally waiting for life to happen to them. Like, we just don't operate like this as Europeans. It's a completely different world to us. And hey, look, fine, I'm not a cultural relativist. I think ours is far better, as shown by the level of civilizational flourishing we were capable of before we intermixed with these inferior cultures. But if they want to pretend that the future doesn't exist and everything's just in the Zamani, that's fine, they can do that over there. But if you input that culture into our civilization, sort of great machine of Anglo-Protestantism in America or English Christianity, you don't get Britain, England, Canada, Australia, America, Northwestern Europe. You don't get that at the end of it. It's like putting Play-Doh into a sausage machine. You don't get sausages, you get Play-Doh at the end. Like, we can't have a civilization if people don't think the future exists. I can't believe those are words that are leaving my mouth. But it's something that the immigration system has never calculated for, because it believes in the blank slate, and it believes that fundamentally all people are exactly the same, and that any cultural, economic, or education differences can be easily remedied. So there's a reason that Africa does not look like Northwestern Europe, and part of that is because they don't believe the future exists.
And this is why, according to Mbiti, African languages, at least the East African Bantu languages that he studied, don't have a word to describe the distant future. In African time, according to Mbiti, events create time. Seasons, ceremonies, a conversation, those moments produce time, and people produce as much time as they need. An example that Mbiti uses from the communities that he studied is that a year is measured based on four seasons, two dry seasons, two wet seasons. So a year is only over when those four seasons have taken place.
Next time I see an African care worker shouting into a speakerphone on the bus or just propped up against a garden wall, which does happen around here, by the way, in Britain, thanks to the Boris Wave, I'll just ask her if she's just producing time.
So a year could take 365 days, 390 days. It doesn't matter the number of days in a year. What matters is that the four seasons have taken place. And this is in contrast to the Western view towards time, where time is a commodity, something that can be spent, saved, wasted, or lost. And according to Mbiti, this is why if foreigners come to Africa and they see people sitting under a tree, they would remark that, okay, why are these people wasting so much time? But in African thought, that sitting under a tree, it's not wasting time. It's either waiting for time or producing time.
Yes. I am very culturally prejudiced against this nonsensical view that the future does not exist and that time does not progress linearly and that you cannot count it. Because it does not produce civilization. It produces thousands of people just milling about under trees, waiting for food to fall into their lap or events to happen to them. That's not how we run our countries. That's not how my sensibilities are attuned, I'm afraid. And so if they would like to go and wait for time, they can do it somewhere else.
For me, I think this Western idea of time as a commodity is what drives this Western obsession of progress, development, and some promised future.
Now, look, I agree, progress is a myth, but that's because the view of the linear progression of history has been dislocated from both the Christian conception of history, which means that we move inexorably towards a day of judgment, and so you have to live as if you know not the hour nor the day when you will be judged, therefore you should always be virtuous, productive, reverent, and serve worthy dependents, and the Greek view of cyclical history, which is not incompatible with the Christian linear view, by the way, in that the fallen human world and the political world goes in cycles. Things like Polybius' idea of you start with a monarchy, it falls into oligarchy, it then falls into democracy, and then falls into mob rule anarchy, and so to rescue someone from the anarchy and the collapse of a civilization, they install a dictator or a monarch again, and the cycle begins. This is not a thing in African thought. The entire future is unpredictable. Things just happen. They appear from the Zamani, as if summoned. How do you share a civilization with that perspective? Again, she seems like a perfectly nice and well-read woman, I don't have any hostility towards her. I just think this idea is mad, and it doesn't produce my civilization if you keep battery farming foreigners in Britain who think that time doesn't exist. So yeah, Smithsonian was right. Time being a linear progression is a property of white European Christian Protestant cultures. So remember when we said this is white supremacy? And they said this is white supremacy, and we said that's racist. Turns out it's just accurate, according to Africans themselves.
And this difference shapes everything, from politics, economics, to how we live our daily lives.
I believe her.
Well, there's a lot to consider and assimilate in what we just heard. But the argument that being on time, speaking English, and taking personal responsibility is white supremacy is obviously a racist statement being based on an association with one's skin color and not with the color of one's ideas. But consider the obvious implication of the other side of that racist coin. You could say, not being on time, not being able to speak English, and not taking personal responsibility is black inferiority. Simple as that. Racist implications aside, the scary thing about what we just heard about how some cultures think about time is that I could actually relate to some of it, if not literally, at least metaphorically. But when it came to the cultural assumptions and consequences drawn from some of these time concepts, that's another matter entirely. I've mentioned my own experience in this regard when having visited Trinidad and Tobago fairly regularly in the past, about their saying something like, "It's Trini time, man," or "Any time is Trinidad time," which explained a lot about why so many things never happened, quote-unquote, on time when I was there. I recall when my Trinidadian in-laws held a party in their home one night, slated with an 8 p.m. start time. You were lucky if the first guest showed up by midnight, and this was considered perfectly normal and acceptable. And that attitude permeated the way a lot of the folks there looked at life. But I'll have a bit more to say about this cultural dimension a little later in the show. Now, according to this African description of time as we just heard it, Sasa is the now, the recent past, and the immediate future. So there is, in fact, some concept of the future, but only in an immediate sense, the adjective immediate being another way of almost describing the present. And Zamani is described as the vast, endless past where all events eventually go to live forever, and because time is made up of events, time has to be experienced in order to be real. And because we cannot conceptualize events tied to the distant future that we haven't experienced yet, therefore the future cannot constitute part of time. Wow. Well, if time has to be experienced to be real, then it only follows that if there were no people around to have these experiences, time wouldn't exist. This entire view of time is a completely self-centered one. It is a form of left-wing thinking, which operates on the primacy of consciousness and rejects the primacy of existence. If I'm not here to experience it, then it doesn't exist, you know? The problem with this logic is that just as one cannot experience, quote-unquote, the future, so too one cannot, quote-unquote, experience the past, a past that would be entirely something different for each individual who experienced something different in the past. And as for the distant past beyond any living person's lifetime, that can only be comprehended or known about through some record of past events. According to African time logic, events create time. People produce as much time as they need. Well, in saying that people produce as much time as they need, I can see the social application of that concept, not unlike what I said during the opening of today's show, when I suggested that we make the time to listen to the show. But it's just an expression. Events don't create time. Events mark time. It seems to me that what they're calling Zamani is what we would call history, a record of the significant events in the past to which we can attach some direct or indirect path of causality, where all events eventually go on to, quote, live forever. But it's the law of causality from which we draw Western culture's concepts of past, present, and future, and of personal responsibility and purpose. Understanding the principle of causality, there is such a concept as the future, unpredictable and indeterminate, and as non-existent as it might be in the present. The concept of time with a past, present, and future is a necessity, a human convention, regardless of the context in which time is being defined, whether in the context of physics or in the context of culture and human activity. We cannot conceptualize events tied to the distant future, it was argued, which is true if you're talking about literally predicting events guaranteed to happen in the present, at which time they will become part of a determined past. But to simply conceptualize and project futuristic events is a staple of much science fiction and fantasy, with many of those futuristic predictions coming uncomfortably close to the mark when contrasted against the present and recent past. Consider the term Orwellian in light of today's social zeitgeist, and consider all of the science fiction technology that has already become a reality and even been surpassed beyond anyone's expectations. I mean, iPhones are a quantum leap beyond the personal communicators used on Star Trek. And it strikes me that if you can't at least conceptualize the possibility of some as yet non-existent invention, activity, or creative venture, which requires the application of time to develop and create, then whatever that is, it cannot possibly happen.
There's so much to explain, I don't know where to begin.
Tell me, why are you behaving like this?
I've just begun to realize how stupid I am to think anybody could possibly understand.
Would you let me try?
Althea, do you believe in the future? I mean that there really is a future for you, your children, mankind?
Yes, of course I do.
And obviously you believe in the past, everybody does. But what if I were to tell you that the past and the future are the same? You think I'm raving?
No, I don't.
I don't blame you. Suppose I told you that time itself doesn't exist. It's only motion we measure, the motion of the Earth spinning, the orbit of the Earth around the sun.
Tony, I'm sorry.
Oh, no. I'm the one who's sorry I frightened you.
You know, it's quite accurate to say that the future does not exist, nor does the past. What exists, quote-unquote, is the here and now, which ironically demands that human beings, in order to survive, must in some way create the abstract concepts that we call the past and future. The past is the determined, the present is the point of action, and the future is the indeterminate, which will instantly become determined by our actions in the present. I mean, the very words you've already heard me say over the past few minutes are already in the past, determined in the sense that the past cannot be altered or changed. What I'm about to say, even if I have some idea of what it is until I actually say it, is in the future, the indeterminate, to ultimately become the determined when I act in the present, and the indeterminate becomes the determined. But I have no idea, at present, what I will say until we listen to the cultural consequences of Sasa and Zamani again, as presented by Connor Tomlinson during his October 6 podcast.
Because in African thought, the golden age isn't in the future, it's actually in the Zamani. According to Mbiti, the future is only a shadow until it comes to the present, and then it flows into the Zamani. So in that way, time moves backwards. We are not the ones who move forward into time. So of course, Mbiti wrote this from a theological point of view because he was trying to explain the nature of African religion. But my main takeaway from the parts of the book that I've read is that unlike Western cultures and religions with end of the world myths, African time has no end. Seasons, years, birth, marriage, death, it's all a cycle. Asante kwa kutazama.
So the most interesting part of that is the idea that the golden age has already happened in the past, and so you can do nothing to bring it about. So there's no point actually doing anything to improve your immediate environment or maintain things. And this is why, as this video that Kunle Drukpa posted, there is no, in many African dialects, word for maintenance or repair. This is just stunning.
You're trying to say that, from what I'm understanding, in third world countries, anything that is not under maintenance is because, you know, we don't care.
No, you care. It's not in the concept. Travel the 54 countries in Africa. Ask each person in every country, what is wrong with your country? Leadership. Leadership. All of you say the same word. So let me ask you, since 1960, the country has been picking the wrong leader every 4 years.
That's important, by the way, because it says that all of our personal circumstances are not products of our actions. It is the product of some external force that has hit like a lightning rod on one particular leader. So it's that guy's responsibility to fix the entire country, because it's not your responsibility, because the events have not befallen you yet. So you can't take proactive, predictable action in order to improve your immediate circumstances. Instead, the particles of the Zamani must collect around one leader who is going to fix things, hypothetically. And so if the leader doesn't fix it, then the problem is only ever the leadership, rather than you not taking personal responsibility to improve your circumstances.
The single railway built by the British is in Nigeria today, but the one they built in their country that same year, it's still running. Not a single railway built in Ghana in 1960 is still there today. What do you know in that country that has been properly maintained by the people every day and it works perfectly?
It's hard for people to maintain things when they're not gaining a lot.
No. It's hard for people to maintain things when they don't have the concept of maintenance in their culture. What is the one word in Igbo for maintenance?
Maintenance is, there's no direct English word for that. It doesn't translate directly to maintenance.
That's correct. How about you?
It doesn't translate.
That's correct.
But it translates to like take care of.
No, that's not maintenance.
So if we are entrusting generations of first generation and second generation African immigrants to be the custodians of our civilization, not only do they have no reverence or frame of reference for our culture, they don't even have a word for maintenance. Like, they don't know what they're meant to do with the things that they have inherited, that they're currently using. They just run them into the ground and move on. They just leave them there in disrepair. How is this sustainable? It's not. And by the way, the reason I'm saying all this is because the birth rate trends that we have show that there's only going to be like four countries in Africa and two in Asia that are going to have above replacement birth rates by 2100. And the conclusion of that study's scholars, who were of course sponsored by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, is that we'll just source all of our immigrants from there for the rest of the world. Okay, one, not sustainable. Two, every single country will end up collapsing into disrepair and lose its entire culture, because these people can't maintain it, not because they're necessarily bad people, but because they have no concept of maintenance in the first place. This is insane. And this is just them saying it themselves.
What is the one word for repair in Igbo?
Imezi.
Exactly. What is the one word for repair in... You see? I'm driving you to somewhere. What is the one word for democracy in Igbo language? You don't. How about you? You don't. You're trying to practice something that is not in the concept of the language.
So they will just run it into the ground until it needs to be fixed, but they have no idea how to fix it because they haven't been maintaining it. So it just lies disrepaired. Like, if they don't have a concept of democracy, then how are they meant to participate in an individualistic issues-based democracy and rather than just use it, as Eric Kaufman pointed out in White Shift, as a means to collectively bargain for resource reallocation to their particular tribe or ethnicity or family group? Like, how do we run a civilization like this?
There is no African country, and I've done it through Kenya, through Adaniral, that has an equivalent of the word maintenance.
Well, in order to maintain something, you have to have it first, correct?
No, if I leave it for you, you can maintain it. The British left a lot of things in this country when they left. They established the hospitals, they established the fire station, the post offices, the railway lines, the roads they built before they left. You are not able to maintain it because you don't have that concept.
Well,
because your environment, the tropical environment of Africa, the way you build your houses, the material you use, you don't require maintenance. Every country that is called industrialized countries today, one of the things you know about them is maintenance of what they had. That's why we have buildings here that are about 250 years old, 300 years old in this country. There are buildings in other countries of Europe that are 700 years ago. The Notre Dame that burned in France was a 13th century building. Do you know what kept it that long till today? Maintenance is a culture.
Now, this chap seems like a well-educated outlier, and Africa would do far better to have people like him running literally everything. But then you see what he has to work with. It's entire populations that don't understand long-term planning. They think the future is entirely unpredictable. They think time is not linear. They think the golden age has already passed, and so there's no point in working for the future. They think you can't maintain a thing if it exists. They inherited the infrastructure of the British Empire and let it fall into disrepair, hence the frustration, famously, of the Chinese chap in the documentary Empire of Dust, who became the meme, "It's all so tiresome." And this has very dangerous impacts on people's ability to take personal responsibility and extend moral consideration out beyond themselves or their family, and to not do serious moral crimes so long as they think they won't get caught and suffer any consequences. And the most famous interaction of this is Ross Kemp talking to a group of African men about why they shouldn't commit sexual abuse. And they find it inconceivable to empathize with the victim of the sexual abuse. The only reasons they can think of not to do it is if they suffer some personal adverse consequence, like a punishment or being beaten by a family member who overhears, or if the woman gets pregnant, or if they contract a sexually transmitted disease. These people don't have a concept of universal ethics, and they don't have a concept of extrapolating more than one step out from gratifying their emotions and impulses, and taking what they want at the expense of someone else.
Guys, let's go.
Some of them, they're not screaming. It's like they wanted to be raped, you see. She also grabs you, you see, no
it's
more
like
crying.
She's like, enjoying it, you know, see? Even though she isn't, but it's like she's enjoying it.
Do you think it's right? Do you think it's right to rape?
Yeah, it's wrong. Yeah, it's wrong.
What about the consequences of what you're doing in terms of how that affects
exactly
the person that's raped?
Yeah, the consequences, we look at that all the time, you know, because it happens, she might scream, you know, people might wake up. A lot of people, especially.
I'm not just talking about, I'm talking about the emotional effect, the physical effect it has on
the
girl.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Sometimes we know that we might rape her and wake up tomorrow with viruses ourselves, like HIV, you know.
What about regretting what you've done to the girl?
I also do regret about it, because if she fell pregnant, what will be that baby's father? Who will be that baby's father?
But what about her personal feelings?
Just blank stares and silence. No wonder we in Britain are now the number one country in Western Europe, second in all of Europe, for crimes committed by foreign nationals. I think we're the 18th in the world out of over 120 countries. It's because we keep importing people like this. And these people are mixed in among the interpersonally nice and friendly African people who don't cause much trouble but will not sustain our culture because they don't have words or concepts for the future or long-term planning or maintenance. These people still aren't going to maintain our civilizations. And so we have to understand how Africa and the broader third world thinks, because if we don't do something soon to encourage them all to leave, our civilization is going to fall into disrepair and they're not going to know how to put it back together again.
You are listening to Just Right, broadcasting around the world and online. I find it ironic that those who refuse to see and use time as a commodity have no problem with seeing and using other people as a commodity. It never ceases to amaze me. But the real punchline of this last commentary was in the statement that maintenance is a culture. Once again, I was reminded of my experiences in Trinidad and Tobago, where the lack of maintenance of some of its most basic services and functions was both a concrete reality, referring to all of the potholes in its road system, and a symbolic statement, referring to the lines that they painted around the potholes so that they could be seen at night when lit by someone's car headlights. And as far as fixing the potholes themselves was concerned, well, that was subject to Trinidad time, if you catch my drift. In African thought, we are told, the golden age isn't in the future, it's in the zamani. The future is a shadow, then it comes into the present and then flows into the zamani. In that way, time moves backwards. We are not the ones who move forward in time. Well, that gives the phrase backward nation a whole new meaning, doesn't it? One comment I found interesting was the statement that, unlike Western cultures and religions with end-of-the-world myths, African time has no end. Everything is a cycle. Well, I don't know how most people might think about this, but I personally do not equate the end of the world with the cessation of time itself. But to someone who equates time with events, you can see how a scientific concept of time is not even a thing. The end of the world would be an event, wouldn't it? And therefore be equated with the end of time itself. However, I could agree that time has no end, in a sense that I previously described on past broadcasts, with time being the perpetual or infinite present which comprises existence itself. Now, I'm not going to pretend that time is an easy concept to discuss, especially since it depends totally on the context and nature of the given discussion. But even when those parameters are established, it's not as if we can experience time in the way described within some of these African cultures. We can only really apprehend time abstractly, conceptually, and not in ways that are really perceptible to our senses. For example, we might say that we experience time as dragging along in slow motion, especially when we're bored or otherwise not engaged in some activity that interests us. Or, on the contrary, you might say that, you know, time flies when you're having fun. Do either of these two expressions actually describe an experience of time, or just of boredom versus excitement? And I would say the latter. Both experiences could be occurring in the same room by two different people, but that doesn't mean that the clock is moving faster for the person having fun than it is for the person who's bored. And speaking of clocks, here's where things get interesting when talking about time itself. When we watch the second hand of a clock, for example, moving forward 1 second with every tick or pulse, what is it that is actually being measured? Is it time? I don't think so. Not really. Time is the means of measurement, not the object of the measurement. It is motion, as we heard described earlier, that is the object of the measurement. Thanks to a millennia of previous observations and calculations, humanity has created a means of accurately counting the number of days between the start of an orbit around the sun and the point at the end of that orbit, which, relative to the sun, of course, would be in the same position as the year earlier. That measurement has been divided into 365 and a quarter days, which we call a year, while the daily rotation of the Earth has been divided into 24 equal units called hours, with each hour divided into 60 equal units we call minutes, and with each minute divided into 60 units we call seconds. So when we're watching a clock measuring motion, second by second, strange as it may seem, we are neither experiencing, quote-unquote, time, nor the motion itself, since we're unaware of our own planet's motion in the sense of feeling it. However, I can personally attest to having witnessed the motion of the Earth, having slept many a night during my youth under a starry sky far away from any city. As the stars and perhaps even the moon slowly move across the sky, you will be aware of the Earth's motion if your eyes stay focused on the sky. But back to my clock analogy, again, when one is watching the second hand move, quote-unquote, forward from 1 to 2 to 3, etc., does that actually mean that time itself is moving forward and not backwards? Of course, we consider the future in front of us and the past behind us. So it's only natural that we would think of time as moving forward, given our acceptance of the concept of a future. But if your culture has no concept of the future, well, guess what? There's only one quote-unquote direction in which time could move, backwards. Which, even as a metaphor, is completely illogical, and yes, it's backwards.
They say time is the fire in which we burn. Right now, Captain, my time is running out. We leave so many things unfinished in our lives. I know you understand.
We refer to past events as history, But unless that history was recorded or written down in some manner, the past remains as unknown to us as does the indeterminate future. But events in the past that actually did occur, but remain unknown to us, do not mean that there wasn't an unknown and unexperienced past that at one time did exist in the present. Because what we call the past refers to a condition and circumstance that was once the present. You know, I recall one occasion when Salim Mansour was a guest on the show, and he mentioned some historical event in India during which apparently millions were killed. And I asked him how it was that no one I was familiar with had ever mentioned such a cataclysmic event. Well, he replied, because nobody wrote about it. Speaking to Western audiences, of course. Which causes me to recall my own political action mantra: if you don't write it down and record your actions and advocacies, they didn't happen, and they didn't even exist. That's how we know that something happened in history. Human beings are ruled by narratives, and narratives form the history, the philosophy, and the cultures in which we live. So now, turning our focus to the Middle East, Africa, and the Islamic world, once again, Connor Tomlinson, this time from an earlier podcast dated August 23rd, but bearing a similar title to We Don't Understand How Africa Thinks, this time worded We Don't Understand How the Third World Thinks. And this has many similarities with the former analysis, but focused more on the cultural consequences of failing to appreciate time as a commodity, or failing to appreciate a future life on Earth as something to be experienced.
How does the Third World think? It's a question that we, the opponents of mass immigration and multiculturalism, rarely grapple with, but it is important because, if left unchecked, the growth of these diasporas and demographics in our country will fundamentally transform our culture because they don't share the same moral priors or theory of mind as we individualistic Westerners do. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to compare and contrast a couple of examples from the last week from the UK and US of third world behaviour, and then attempt to explain through the words of third world heritage authors why these people do the things that they do. The first example is an attempted honour killing that happened in Washington State in the US. Now, I'm going to be talking throughout this, by the way, mainly about the Middle East and Africa, particularly the Islamic world. Anyway, in this particular case, you've got a mother and father. This is Ishan Ali and Zahra Supi Mohsin Ali, who attacked their daughter Fatima on October the 18th, 2024. It was caught on video there, as you can see. Ishan was jailed for 14 months for second degree assault, 12 months for unlawful imprisonment to be served concurrently, and given 18 months of community custody and banned from seeing his daughter for 10 years and interacting with her boyfriend, who is black and not a Muslim, Isaiah, for at least 2 years, because he got 182 days in prison for fourth degree assault because he punched her boyfriend, who was 16 at the time, in the face. This is because his daughter was fleeing an arranged marriage he had set up with an older man in Iraq. And arranged marriages are very common in the Islamic world because you treat your daughters like a commodity, and the marital arrangements that you set up for them can confer either honor or shame on your family, and this can result in reputational damage, economic penalties. And so this is why honor killings are common, because if your daughter is a net detriment to the family's honor, it actually restores honor by killing her rather than allowing her to go and live a Westernized liberal life. But the most interesting part of this story is actually the judge in this, because it shows that multiculturalism was not, as promised, an intermingling of cultures to create a melting pot, a enriched milieu of interesting and exotic cuisines and beliefs. Instead, it's two parallel traditions racing towards each other like trains on a track, heading for collision, or tectonic plates that rub up against each other and cause cultural tsunamis or earthquakes or sort of geysers of conflict that erupt and have splash damage and cause lots of casualties. So during the course of this, This is Judge Shaler. The judge ruled that the trial prosecutors couldn't bring up the arranged marriage, even though it is key to the case, and the judge didn't allow Fatima to talk in detail about a family trip to Iraq when she was 16, essentially to set up the transactional marriage in question. The veracity of the arranged marriage claim is less clear, the article for the Daily Mail writes, but it was wholly denied by the defense during the trial. Quote, "The entirety of the claims appears to be the result of Islamophobia," Ihsan's lawyer, the father, Eric Kading, wrote in his own memorandum. "There is no evidence of either honor killing or arranged marriage supported by the evidence uncovered in the investigation of the case, other than the fact they were beating her and attempting to strangle her on video." So, what you have to understand, this is the reason why the grooming gang perpetrators always plead not guilty every time, is that guilt and innocence is not a concept that relates to the individual conscience in this part of the world. Instead, being honest can bring dishonor on the family collectively, so you will lie if you think you can get away with doing something evil so that you do not disgrace your family in the eyes of the Muslim collective who will judge and shame you. And also, if you do not recognize the authority of the liberal or Christian secular Western institutions, then you don't see what you have done as a crime by their standards. And so their attempt to impose their standards on you is Islamophobic. It was a term invented, of course, by the Muslim Brotherhood to insulate Islam from criticism in the same way that Jewish activists after the atrocities of the Holocaust or gay rights activists in the 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s did for their respective identities. But in this instance, the term is being used to describe the imposing of foreign standards, our standards, on Islam, on these tribal sectarian self-governing enclaves that have taken root in our country and are not content to live by our rules, and they never will. And the best person that has articulated this is actually Ayaan Hirsi Ali in her book Heretic from 2016. There is a passage where she describes why Islamic honor culture happens, and I'll just read it to you here. "Anthropologists since Ruth Benedict's study of Japan in World War II have made a distinction between shame cultures and guilt cultures. In the former, social order is maintained by the inculcation of a sense of honor and shame before the group. If our behavior brings discredit on our tribe, it may punish or even expel us. In a guilt culture, by contrast, a person is taught to discipline himself by means of his own conscience, sometimes backed up by the threat of punishment in the life to come. Most Western societies went through a thousand-year transformation from shame to guilt, a process that coincided with the gradual breakup of tribal family structures. Europeans underwent a long process of detribalization, beginning with subjection to Roman law, conversion to Christianity, the imposition of monarchical rule over baronial power, and the gradual rise of nation-states with their concept of individual citizenship and equality before the law." So all of these are based on distinctly Christian foundations, and particularly Western family structures with low rates of cousin marriage. If you have a high rate of cousin marriage, if you have a high rate of incest, which happens commonly in the Muslim world and in Africa, then your entire focus is around your ethnic and familial in-group. So you don't extend moral consideration outside of that in-group, and you do everything you can to advantage that in-group, meaning lying, cheating, and stealing is permissible. And in fact, if a person falls for your lies, your scams, your theft, then they are the sucker, and you're actually more intelligent than them, and so you have an obligation to take advantage of people if and where you can, because it is to the benefit of your collective, rather than having a kind of Jiminy Cricket gnawing away at you in your ear that was instilled in people thanks to, yes, a reduction in cousin marriage, but also the idea that the logos places a burden on the individual to understand and articulate and enact their morality. This comes from ancient Greece, of course, but is given flesh, as it were, in the Christian tradition. None of this is present in the Islamic world, and none of this is present in the largely illiterate and very tribal regions of Africa. Nowhere in that equation are the people living alongside them, the native Christian or even atheist Westerners, who largely are paying for them to be in their countries. Again, integration is not possible because the thought never enters their heads, and if they are presented with the prospect, they have an antibody reaction to the idea because it violates all of their moral priors. It's just not going to happen. And there are low-level, innocuous ways that this manifests beyond things like honor-based violence and attempted murder of their own children, and that is just the casual littering and disregard for public spaces, a tragedy of the commons approach to our country. This is outside Marble Arch Station, and the Met Police have decided to put up signs in Arabic saying, "Cleanliness is half of your faith. Clean hearts reflected by clean surroundings keep London tidy." If cleanliness was half of their faith, you wouldn't need these signs. In a passage that I tweeted out from Ayaan Hirsi Ali's book, this explains perfectly why littering, a tragedy of the commons approach to public spaces, is so common among people from the Muslim world. Quote, "As a translator for other Somalis who had arrived in Holland, Ayaan saw this phenomenon in various forms. One was simply the clash of cultures when immigrant Muslims and native-born Dutch lived in close proximity to one another. In apartment complexes, the Dutch were generally meticulous about keeping common spaces free of any litter. The immigrants, however, would throw down wrappers, empty Coca-Cola cans and cigarette butts, or spit out the remnants of their chewed cat. The Dutch residents would grow incensed at this, just as they would grow incensed about the groups of children who would run about, wild and unsupervised at all hours. It was easy for one family to have many children. If a man can marry up to four wives and have multiple children with each of them, the numbers grow quickly. The Dutch would shake their heads, and in reply, the veiled mothers would simply shrug their shoulders and say that it was God's will. Trash on the ground became God's will. Children racing around in the dark became God's will. Allah has willed it to be this way. It is there because Allah has willed it, and if Allah has willed it, Allah will provide. It is an unbreakable ring of circular logic. There is a fatalism that creeps into one's worldview when this life is seen as transitory and the next is seen as the only one that matters. Why pick up trash? Why discipline your children? When none of these acts is stored up for any type of reward. Those are not the behaviors that mark good Muslims. They have nothing to do with praying or proselytizing." So, not only do they disrespect the law of the land in Western countries, not only do they see our morality as illegitimate, not only are their ears clogged up and deaf to our pleas to respect our laws as if we are their moral equals, because they don't see us as that, but the almost Gnostic belief that tomorrow may never come, that inshallah, literally everything that happens is a result of Allah's predetermined will, this leads to a kind of inability to plan for the long term, an unwillingness to ensure that your area is clean and that you act as a custodian for things that you impart onto future generations. And it means that there's no incentive to act as a considerate citizen. And so it means that they will just throw rubbish on their doorstep, treat the world outside their home as a wilderness, and do whatever they want when the mood strikes. A great cartoon that I actually saw someone post that explains how the third world think is this, from a kid's cartoon. "Haggis the dog has a hole in his roof. He never fixed it because on rainy days it is too wet to work, and on sunny days it doesn't need fixing. These people live in the immediate here and now. They do not think that on the sunny day it would be a good idea to fix the roof because a rainy day might come. Instead, they just think, oh, it is raining now, so I can't do this. There is no step 2, 3, or 4 to their thinking. They are permanently on step 1. And trying to get them to address abstract hypotheticals or plan long term is basically impossible. Conversations about integration, we are well past that, because you do not understand how these people think."
Can we even call it thinking at all? And once again, I find myself enlightened about a past personal experience that I couldn't explain at the time. I used to work daily in the office of Freedom Party, which at the time was located in a small strip plaza where our office was near the south end of the plaza, and where a variety store that had recently been taken over and operated by Muslims was located at the north end. And having been a resident of that plaza for many years, it was hard not to notice the sudden accumulation of garbage and litter that was blown over the plaza parking lot since that variety store was operated by its new owners. As a consequence, the first thing I was compelled to do each morning when I arrived at work was to pick up all of the garbage and litter strewn across the parking area and lawn. On one occasion while I was doing this, the owner of the store stuck his head out the door and very politely, in a friendly tone, thanked me for cleaning up the lot. And in a joking response, I suggested that he could occasionally do the same as well. Well, the next thing I knew, he was accusing me of being a racist. I didn't know how to respond because there was no way I could relate cleaning up litter and garbage with race. I laughed, taking it as a joke, and assuming that perhaps that I had somehow embarrassed him, only to learn later that he was telling other people who were volunteers in our office that I was a racist. Now I understand. This wasn't about race, it was about culture. And now I also understand and have connected the dots between the left's opposition to maintenance and, go figure, private property. Responsible property ownership requires maintenance and all of the virtues that go along with that. No wonder the left chants, "You will own nothing and be happy." And as Connor Tomlinson summarized it earlier, in some of these cultures, long-term planning and personal responsibility are not concepts, so we need to understand how these people think if they are in our own civilization. And with such alien understanding of time and future planning, you won't get the same civilization at the end, even if they are perfectly nice people, end quote.
Well, I think we have to tell him the truth.
If we tell the truth, the timeline...
Timeline? This is no time to argue about time. We don't have the time.
Well, I'm glad you made the time to make it to this point in the show. And yes, we simply don't have the time left to cover every aspect of how humanity's concept of time influences philosophy and behavior. But in addressing a fundamental truth at the base of all this time runs backwards, there is no future ideology, what I see is a great human evil. It's called laziness and a refusal to accept personal responsibility for one's own circumstance in life. Coupled with a submission to determinism and a rejection of free will, it shouldn't be surprising that such cultures, ironically you might say, have no future. Trying to experience time as if it was some kind of entity unto itself will only lead to contradictory and circular arguments, proving very little and justifying anything. However, understanding time as a commodity with its power of accurate measurement is the closest that humans can get to anything in terms of being able to project future possibilities from which spring the miracles of human creativity. But for our part, let's keep it simple by limiting our future projections to just 1 week from now when we can all get together again as we continue our journey in the right direction. And until then, be right, stay right, do right, act right, think right, and be right back here. We'll see you then.
Fade into color, color into black and white. Under the bedclothes, everything will be all right.
What do you think of the Catholic Church?
What do I think of the Catholic Church? You know what, my friend? You know what question you got to ask yourself? As opposed to what? Right? Because, yeah, the Catholic Church, yeah. But look at what they offer, right? Let's say, you read a lot about these jihadist guys, right? They blow shit up. And why do they do it? They do it because they get 72 virgins when they die. Become a Catholic priest and have them now. The Catholic Church did a lot of bad things, but they did a lot of good things too. I'm not a religious man, but they did a lot of good things. If you think about universities, right? You like universities and education and science. That all started with the monasteries. That's where knowledge was first accumulated, right? And the other thing they did, the Catholic Church, is they banned cousin marriage in about the year 1200. And that changed the face of Europe. Because... I mean, literally and metaphorically. We've now got chins because of those guys. The Catholic Church banned cousin marriage to break the tribes, because the tribes were as important, if not more important, than the church. And they wanted to break that, so they banned cousin marriage up to six cousins deep, right? And that meant everyone had to get along with other people, and you had to trust other people, and you had to have contracts, and it took away nepotism and corruption. And it made us thrive. That was the unintended consequence. So the Catholic Church gave us modern Europe. and I like it.